You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, more and more technology workers are looking for new jobs. Many visa holders are now scrambling to find work to stay in the U.S. Jen White asks, what's behind the surge in big tech layoffs? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, does this sound familiar?
Jingle bells, Batman smells, Robin laid an egg. Batmobile lost its wheel, the Joker got away. Hey!
Singer Robert Goulet on The Simpsons with a timely parody song that's well known to Bart and the other kids and to real life kids from multiple generations. It's just one example of something called child lore, the games like Miss Mary Mac or songs like Ring Around the Rosie or those folding fortune tellers that end up as kind of a shared kid culture. Our next guest recently looked into how all this stuff becomes child lore and how it changes depending on when and where you learned it. You can join in at 800-642-1234, hoping you'll join in with your memories, however distant they may be of those bits of child lore in your own childhood, if I can say all the words here. Clapping games, urban legends, parody songs, you name it. What memories do you have of sharing that stuff with other kids? Where did you learn it from, if you remember? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you see these things in your own kids, love to hear about that too. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Julie Beck is a senior editor at The Atlantic who oversees the family section. She's the creator of The Friendship Files. Her latest piece about childhood traditions and how they get passed down is titled, Why Do We All Have the Same Childhood? Julie, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, reading your piece, I was like, oh yeah, I remember all this stuff, and I probably hadn't thought about it in literally decades. What got you interested in taking a closer look at this child lore?
Yeah, well, before I knew that it was called child lore, in my mind, I was just sort of thinking of it as like the memes of the schoolyard, because I was thinking about like how these things spread and we all seem to know them. You know, there's always like BuzzFeed listicles or whatever of like things only 90s kids remember. And it's like the cool S or like the cootie catchers or all these things. And I had always sort of idly wondered, how is it that we do all know these things? Because it's not like kids have like a robust, you know, network across the nation. So yeah. And then when I looked into it, it turned out that really this is a subgenre of folklore. And it's folklore that is specific to kids and kid culture.
And child lore, reading your piece and looking into it more, it covers a lot of ground. You mentioned a couple, those origami cootie catchers, so-called the fortune-telling things that I didn't have the folding talent to make when I was a kid. little tricks with calculators, little art things, songs. This is a lot of ground we're covering here.
Yeah, it's a really broad category. Really anything that is a piece of culture that kids have adopted and made their own could be child lore. So that can be all of the examples you mentioned. That can be jump rope rhymes, nursery rhymes, clapping games, even like something as small as like typing out naughty words on a calculator, right? Like that can be child lore too. So yeah, it really does span a wide array of things and it can kind of ebb and flow. But what was the most interesting to me was how many of these things persist through the generations. One of the folklorists I spoke to was much older than me and is British, and we shared a ton of the same references. So I thought that was pretty cool, just the longevity of it.
Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, looking at child lore, the little games and customs and songs and tricks and things like that that are common to kids, as Julie was just saying, from different generations, often from different places. You can join in. Do you have a memory of these things yourself? Or are you seeing it right now in your own kids? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Now, Julie, a big question you tackled here is, a lot of these things were around a long time, of course, before we had the internet, yet they spread like memes. What do we know about how the same customs might be, as you just mentioned, in the United States and England and in a generation or two apart? How do these things spread?
Yeah, so the answer is kind of simple, and maybe you will find that disappointing, but it's actually pretty cool. It really is something that catches on to the degree that children want to teach it to each other. And so within a school, you know, older generations will be teaching the younger generations. Within the home, like, siblings are really important, especially, you know, if you have an older sibling, you probably think they're really cool and want to emulate whatever they're doing. And then something that was mentioned to me as well was really the power of, like, cousins, which seems really random, but, like, those are often the closest peers that kids have who don't go to their school, but they do see them regularly. So there's, like, cross-pollination happening with cousins, or if new kids move to new schools and they bring their lore from their old school. So all of those things seem really simple. And yet, like, if something is catchy enough and, like, cool enough to kids, like, that will be enough to really spread it, like, across the country.
You also write, I think, about, the game of tag, which just appears like, we're running around tagging each other. I remember who taught me tag, and there are different permutations involving often diseases around tag. Could you talk about what you learned about that really basic playground game?
Yeah, I mean, the origin of tag, I could not tell you. Like, it is timeless. It came from everywhere and nowhere, but kids take that structure and they iterate it depending on what they're interested in or what they're thinking about. And, like, obviously you've probably played a lot of variations yourself, like freeze tag or the floor is lava or whatever. But it's also a structure that they can use to kind of work through what is going on around them. And so a colleague of mine, Kate Cray, actually wrote a piece in, like, March or April 2020 about how kids were starting to play coronavirus tag. And parents were worried, like, does this mean, you know, their kids are really traumatized and upset? Should we be worried about this? And, you know, experts told her at the time, like, no, this is so healthy. Like, this is play is how children, work through things. And when I was reporting this story, and I mentioned that to a folklorist, they said, you know, I would not be surprised if in Victorian times they were playing cholera tag or something like that. Like, it's just a structure that is there and that kids build on with their interests or whatever they're working through. And I think that's part of what makes it, you know, so long lived.
And speaking of grownups being worried about kids, I think there's a sense like, oh, there's the internet and screens and social media, and now kids are doing childhood wrong. Is this killing those old traditional childhood games, the interconnected world we have?
Oh my goodness, no. And in fact, like, every single folklorist that I spoke to or whose, like, book I read, every single one, like, had the same thing that they wanted to emphasize, which is that adults, like, throughout history have always said kids don't know how to play anymore. And they're blaming, you know, whatever the technology of the day is, probably, like, today it would be internet and TikTok. And, like, when it was TV, like, TV was, you know, the problem. But they seem to think that part of the reason for that is because, like, child lore is sort of like a language and a culture that is of kids, by kids, for kids, and it is not for us. And so we don't always recognize it when we see it. We might just think, like, kids are running around on the playground screaming and going wild, but, like, to them, it is a game that, like, has a purpose and an organized principle, and, like, we just don't always see that.
Another thing that's fun is, regional variation, things are different. I think when you're talking to the English expert, you mentioned Jingle Bells, Batman Smells. What does Robin do?
Oh, yeah. Well, so you played the clip from The Simpsons, which is the one that I know, which is Robin laid an egg. And he said that he grew up singing Robin Flew Away. I like laid an egg better, but to each their own. But yeah, that is another element of it, right? Is, like, there is consistency, like, remarkable consistency, and there is also variation depending on the time you grew up, where exactly you grew up, what was cool at your school, that sort of thing.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I believe Ring Around the Rosie is talking about the plague.
I have heard that too. Is this one you grew up playing yourself, Susie, doing Ring Around the Rosie? Yeah. I remember when I was a little kid, I did that.
Yeah. And Ashes, Ashes, We All Fall Down, I believe, is when they burned down towns. They would seal a town not let anybody out and just burn the whole thing down to try to stop the plague from growing.
Susie, thanks for the call. I've heard that. Julie, I've also heard that is wrong, and I'm not sure we're settled on the origins of Ring Around the Rosie. The tricky thing is, like you were saying with Tag, it may be that we never know where these things end up coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, you know, professional folklorists, like, can actually trace some of these things, probably not all of them, much better than, you know, me, a random person, can. I don't want to, you know, commit on air to something I'm not sure about, but I'm pretty sure that in the book of the folklorist, the British folklorist Steve Rowe that I read, he had debunked one of those things. I can't remember if it was Ring Around the Rosie or some other kids game that's like associated with the plague. But it seemed like more questionable that that actually was the origin. Like that sort of maybe folklore in itself that like now we think that it was, you know, the plague at the time. So it's like folklore on top of folklore.
I love it. Thanks a lot for bringing that up. We're talking to Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees their family section, with us today to talk about her latest piece looking at traditions of childhood, otherwise known as child lore. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember some of these? Are you just thinking back about them now? Maybe something you haven't thought of in a good long while, depending on how old you were. What is one of these things you might remember from your school? A version of Tag. Did you use those folding things to answer fortune teller type questions? Does he or she like me? That kind of important question to a fourth or fifth grader. Other songs or parodies or games? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about child lore, those clapping games, silly song parodies, and so much more that have become childhood traditions. Julie Beck stays with us from The Atlantic. She wrote a recent piece about this. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a memory of one of these, a question, if you remember who taught something like this to you, well, that's a tall order maybe, but if you do, I'd love to hear it. 800-642-1234. A jumping jack, a rhyme that you did, or jump rope thing that you did, a rhyme that you did. Let us know. 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Bryn is with us in North Freedom. Bryn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Bryn?
MASH, the person on air may instantly know what that is, but mansion, apartment, shack, house, a game on a piece of paper with pencil marks and figuring out what your future holds.
Oh, wow. Okay. That is just starting to come back to me. I don't remember if we called it MASH, but yeah, it was like kind of a weird fortune telling thing. Do you remember any of your fortunes, Bryn, from back in the day? Oh, I think we lost Bryn. Julie, is that one you ran across?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I never forgot about MASH. It's hard to describe to people who don't know, because this is not a visual medium, but you know, you would write, it would be sort of like a fortune telling game for your future, right? And so as the caller mentioned, you'd write MASH on the top, and that was like, are you going to live in a mansion, apartment, shack, or house? Yeah, you'd put all your crushes on there, whether that was like celebrity crushes or people from school. And then you would do, you know, sort of like a random number generating thing. And then you'd count it out. And that's like who you were going to marry, where you were going to live, how many kids you would have, like all of that.
Thanks a lot for bringing that up, Bryn. You know what? I don't remember if I did that. I know my kids did it. That's why it seems so familiar. Bryn, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Julie, are we seeing new things like this getting created now, not just passed on, but new, whole new things or new versions of them?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about child lore is that it is sort of a paradox in that it is like very stable, but also always in flux, right? Like, so there are all kinds of things that are child lore that don't get passed on, you know, for hundreds and hundreds of years, because they're kind of specific to the time that they come up in, right? So, for example, when I was a kid in elementary school, like my friends and I used to pretend to be the witches from Hocus Pocus on the playground, and we would play that all the time. And, you know, after that movie was not super popular anymore, I doubt anybody was like thinking to play that, although they did just put out a sequel, so maybe it's coming back. Yeah, there's all kinds of things that are tied to pop culture. Kids love to play, you know, games related to that. And then there's probably also just like trends that come up in a school and they don't necessarily become super widespread. So all of that is child lore. The distinction is, you know, the pop culture itself. So like Paw Patrol is not child lore. Like that was made by adults for children, but the games that kids play when they're pretending to be Paw Patrol characters, that is child lore, because what makes it child lore is kids making it their own.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Ginny on the road by Dodgeville. Ginny, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Ginny?
Well, I grew up on a dairy farm in southwest Wisconsin, so we kind of had to make our own entertainment. And I remember three games. One was called Red Rover, Red Rover. And then you'd say, send, you know, like Robbie right over. And that kid would like run across and try to break like through a line of kids holding hands. And then the other one was a Annie Annie Over, where you threw a ball over the roof. We had a smokehouse, so the person on the other side would catch it, and then they had to try to figure out which side the person who threw the ball was coming, and if you hit them with the ball before they got all the way around, then you won, you know? And then the last one was Cat's Cradle, where you used a string, and you kind of move the string around, and then you pass it from back and forth. It was really fun.
Thank you so much for sharing those. I was in southeastern Michigan growing up. I was Robbie, and I played Red Rover. In my head, I was really good at Red Rover. I don't think I have the statistics to back those up. But, Julie, Ginny had some great examples. Those are exactly the sorts of things we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew Red Rover, and I knew Cat's Cradle, but I didn't know the throwing over the roof game. I grew up in southeastern Michigan as well, so we'd played a lot of Red Rover. I was not good at it. I've never been like a good runner. I could never break through their hands. So that one wasn't my favorite, but I do remember.
Ginny, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Talking to Julie Beck from The Atlantic, talking about child lore, those games, those little tricks, the fortune-telling thing, so much more that kids just know and pass on to each other and maybe change and reinvent. And it shows up in different places and times. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Julie, the mention of MASH, most of our Central Time producers seem to remember that fondly. Now, when you were telling people you were writing about this, did you have a lot of those moments like, oh, yeah, I remember that?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I was reading through this book by the British folklorist called The Lore of the Playground, and just every page was, like, bringing back memories, like, of these clapping games that I used to play and, like, the sort of various rules for different, like, hopscotch games or, like, tag variations. Some of the things I had, you know, remembered over the years, but it's sort of like the Proustian Madeleine, right? Like, somebody mentions it, and it just, like, comes flooding back all the memories.
I did a couple of the things you wrote about I hadn't heard of, but I was able to watch YouTube videos about them. I don't. Do you think that's going to help? I mentioned, you know, is technology going to kill these things? Is technology going to help amplify some of these things?
I think so, yeah. One of the researchers I spoke with, her specialty is kind of, you know, new media and play. And she mentioned that, yeah, sometimes kids will look up the rules for this or that clapping game online. So that is another way that it spreads. And it makes me wonder if the sort of regional variants will become a little bit more homogenized if kids are kind of learning in this more universal way online. It's not going to kill play, but it might like shift the way that kids learn these things.
Let's go back to our callers. John is with us in Osseo. John, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm actually a teacher in Osseo, and at the end of my class, if we're done with our schoolwork, I have a softball that I let the kids throw around the room, and they come up with their own rules. I've never introduced a game to them, but every day there's something new. It's like, well, today let's throw it behind our back, or today you have to be on one foot when you throw it. You bounce it off your, if it bounces off your hand, you're out. It's just very interesting watching them create games as they go.
I love it, John. Thanks. And that speaks, Julie, to the inventiveness of children, I think.
Yeah, that's so fun. I mean, I don't know if the softball game is going to sweep the nation, although it might, but it's like what makes it really special is that like it's about the kids' agency and them coming up with what is interesting and fun and stimulating to them. And that's really the case for all of child lore, whether it's something that only exists in our college classroom or, you know, across the whole country.
Thanks for the call, John. Time for one more caller. Lori is with us in northern Wisconsin. Lori, hi.
I just tuned in on the radio, but I remember the game, the clapping game. Oh, Mary, Mac, all dressed in black, black, black. And you cross your arms and go down and
Right.
pat your legs and clap your whoever you're doing it with.
Lori, thanks for that. Julie, I mentioned that as one example, but we haven't talked about those clapping and rhyming games, including, that's a big one, Mary Mac.
Yeah, I loved those. I remember Mary Mac, and there was like a bunch of other ones. And again, like not a visual medium, so hard to like explain. But yeah, they were really fun. And I think there's like been a ton of different regional variations on like how people do those rhymes too.
Lori, thanks for that call. And Julie, thanks a lot for sharing this with us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was really fun.
That's Julie Beck, senior editor at The Atlantic, who oversees the family section. She was with us today to talk about her latest piece there. It's called Why Did We All Have the Same Childhood? Looking at how childhood traditions, child lore is shared. You can keep sharing yours, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, one you remember from your own childhood, one you've seen maybe in your own kid's life. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, December is a big season for charitable giving and volunteering. An expert on philanthropy gives advice on how to make the most impact, no matter how much you're able to give. And as we mark the anniversary of Pearl Harbor and the U.S. entry into World War II, we'll check out a new biography of an American in the middle of the story, the U.S. ambassador in Japan in 1941. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, author B.J. Hollers shares some of his favorite new books from 2022. And you can, too, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case that brought up issues of same-sex marriage, business accommodations, and free speech. We'll check out the arguments and what's at stake. First, at various points over the last couple years, we've checked in with writers and authors about what they're reading and recommending to others. We talked to author and professor B.J. Hollers last fall about a collection of essays he edited from Wisconsinites on the topic of hope. B.J. is back with us now to talk about some of his favorite new books he's read in 2022. And you could do the same at 800-642-1234. Did you have a favorite brand new book you had a hard time putting down this year, or maybe one that was new to you? It doesn't have to be 2022 published. Did you discover any new and exciting authors? Do you have a reading method of choice, physical copy, e-reader, phone, audio? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. B.J. Hollers is an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He's the author of several books, including 13 Loops, Race, Violence, and the Last Lynching in America, and The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. B.J., welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, now you're an English professor. I'm guessing you do a lot of reading and rereading along with your classes. You're an author writing your own books. When do you find time to read books?
Well, a lot over the last week since I got your email, let me tell you. But I had a great time kind of reconnecting with a lot of books I had on my list throughout the year, and I got through a lot of them, thankfully.
Excellent. Any themes standing out to you in 2022 when it comes to fiction or nonfiction?
You know, it's hard for me to pick out themes. I think one thing I'm seeing a lot from my students too is the interest in kind of moving beyond the real world. There's a lot of fantasy elements that these seem to be enjoying and kind of video gaming, which is going to get us to the first fictional book. But in terms of nonfiction, I see a lot of, you know, kind of cultural histories of places, which we might talk about, but also people from the past, historical figures coming out and being thought of in new ways.
And before we start naming names, your list includes some novels, some historical fiction as part of that, literary fiction, essays, memoir, nonfiction. I know sometimes I get into a reading rut. Can you encourage people to, you know, maybe try diversifying? If you always read one thing, maybe check out something else.
You know, there's a quote that my friend says, and I think about this a lot. He says, reading can be a mirror to reflect yourself or a window to peer out of. And so I like that metaphor of especially the window part of it, you know, expand those horizons, try to learn something beyond your own experience.
We are talking about great reads of 2022 with BJ Hollers from UW Eau Claire, an author himself. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been recommending this year? What is new, either this year or new to you, that you've discovered that you're loving? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Okay, you teased this one, BJ. Video game creators in a novel called Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
That's correct. It's by Gabrielle Zevin. Of all the novels I read this year, this one really hit me in an unexpected way. It's the story of Sam and Sadie, two longtime friends who kind of had a falling out in their youth. They reconnect in their college years. They find this shared love of creating video games. And then the beautiful part of this book is that throughout the remaining part of the book, it's about their personal and professional relationships kind of blurring, but also kind of shown through the lens of video gaming. So the beauty of a video game, of course, is that sometimes your character dies and you get to restart and learn a lesson and try again. Real life isn't quite so flexible. And so kind of seeing their lives and relationships evolve through that lens was really poignant.
Now, are you a video game person yourself?
You know, not so much. And that was also what I thought was so cool about this book. If you love video games, you'll love this book. If you don't love video games, sort of like me, you'll probably still love this book.
All right. That's Gabrielle Zevin, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Now let's jump over to the nonfiction world. You shared a title, A Civil Rights Queen, Constance Baker Motley and the Struggle for Equality.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. This was a great read. Tomiko Brown Nagin is the author. I am a big sucker for a book whose notes section is like as long as the narrative. And this is very much that. This book is so meticulously researched. I was so impressed by that. But what's cool about it is it kind of reads like a novel. So a bit about the woman, Constance Baker Motley. She was born in Connecticut in 1921, a Black woman, went on to get her law degree, became a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first Black woman to argue before the Supreme Court, went on to be a state senator. It's a cool story because it's not just like about her meteoric rise. That would be one way to write this book, but it's also about how she had to break the glass ceiling and then realize too that she only did so by playing within a system that doesn't always allow for that glass ceiling breaking. And so one last kind of personal note I'll share about this, which was so fun for me. I was reading this Sunday morning. There was a chapter about the University of Alabama's desegregation, which Constance Baker Motley was very much involved in. And I noted these similarities to a book I wrote about that exact topic. I went to the notes section and sure enough, the author had used my book to write this one little spot. It was such a cool feeling to know I'd had some very small part in a book I now love written by Tomiko Brown Nagin.
That's a pretty cool feeling. Now, I haven't read this one. What I like in biographies sometimes is, yeah, you meet the person, but you kind of get that life and times, the historical context they came out of and grew up in. I'm guessing for what you're saying, this book, Civil Rights Queen, really does that.
Oh my gosh. And that's part of the beauty of when I write these kind of books, I love going through old newspapers, see what was on the movies at that time, you know, who won the sports events there in this particular time, just kind of get an ambiance of that moment in time. In this book, I mean, the names in here, Medgar Evers, James Meredith, Adam Clayton Powell, Martin Luther King, of course, JFK, Lyndon Johnson. It's this cast of characters kind of personalized in a really wonderful way.
Now, here's That Civil Rights Queen by Tomiko Brown Nagin. Now, going back to fiction, this is staying with the historical theme, though. Ken Follett. Now, I read his Pillars of the Earth and I think something else by Ken Follett. I like Pillars of the Earth a lot. It ended up being a trilogy, I want to say, set in medieval England. A prequel called The Evening and the Morning.
This is just pure fun, guilty pleasure read. I mean, this thing clocks in at like 928 pages, but you can read it in like 7 hours.
Oh,
the
wow.
Pages just blur. Maybe not 7 hours, but you know, it goes fast. It goes fast. And what's cool about it, as you mentioned, it's actually a prequel to Pillars of the Earth, which is a very well-known book about cathedral buildings. So this one is set around 1000 CE, and it brings together the story of this modest boat builder and a Norman noblewoman and a monk with these very big ambitions. all of whom find their lives turned upside down in the aftermath of a Viking attack on the shores of modern-day Britain. So if you've read anything from Follett, you know this guy can time travel you anywhere. You know, he will take us to the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages, and you will feel like you've lived half your life there. So that's very much the trick he pulls off again here.
Yeah, I think historical fiction, sometimes I run into like, okay, this feels like a very modern book, a modern conversation, and just with a set in the backdrop of a historical period. That's not what I get in Ken Follett, right? Like, he really tries to capture the flavor of what it was like to live in whatever era he's writing about.
You know, that is exactly it. And I mean, can I throw in a personal experience related to that very topic? I got this book right after I came back from teaching a course in England last summer. So it's like August, and I feel like I really know the history of England all of a sudden since I was just there. And I open this book and I see the names of rivers I walked by and the cities and the cathedrals. And so it was just so true to life. Even 1,000 years later, I could see the same things. I could feel the same emotions. And so that's really a credit to Ken Follett.
Okay, we're going to start moving a little closer to home now. We'll go to Chicago before we stop here in Wisconsin. Last summer on State Street, a little more literary fiction, you say?
Absolutely. I am certainly no book snob, but I do love a good literary fiction piece now and again. And so this is the debut novel of Toya Wolf, a wonderful writer, a wonderful person. It's set in 1999 in the Chicago Housing Authority's Robert Taylor Holmes Projects. And it's the story of four 12-year-old girls in the south side of Chicago, kind of growing apart, amid a very complicated backdrop of friendship lost and found. So it's told retrospectively through our main character, and it kind of reflects on this pivotal moment in their lives. The back cover says, quote, a striking coming-of-age debut about friendship, community, and resilience set in the housing projects of Chicago during one life-changing summer. And that perfectly sums up what this book is all about.
We're talking to BJ Hollers, author and associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He's sharing some of his favorite new books of the year. You can, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you read any of the ones that BJ has mentioned so far? Do you have new books that you've been recommending to friends and family this year, or maybe one that somebody recommended to you? Did you discover a new author, even if their book wasn't brand spanking new in 2022? That is okay. Call in and let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got some a bunch of recommendations, actually, from you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah says, Lessons in Chemistry, a new novel by Bonnie Garmus, and The Firekeeper's Daughter, a YA novel from 2021 by Angeline Bouly, were two of my favorites this year. Liz says she's currently reading The Woman They Could Not Silence by Kate Moore. Liz writes, it's a fascinating and disturbing look at the abuses imposed on women by some husbands, doctors, and institutions in 19th century America. Liz says, I highly recommend. How about you? What are you highly recommending in the book world? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. By the way, we've got BJ's book list for this year linked at wpr.org/centraltime. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about some great new books of 2022. BJ Hollers is with us, associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, author of several books himself, including The Road South, Personal Stories of the Freedom Riders. Got a full list of his book recommendations at wpr.org/centraltime. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your own recommendations. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller. Ingrid is with us in Westby. Ingrid, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Ingrid?
The best book I read all year is by John Armbruster. It's called Tailspin. It's his first book, and it's about a man from Soldier's Grove who fell out of an airplane in World War II and lived to tell about it.
Wow.
An amazing story.
That's great. You're going to look for a few. Is this like a fictionalized version or a nonfiction book, Ingrid?
No, it's not fiction.
Okay.
John's done a lot of research on the book. It's historically accurate, and it's just a tremendous read.
Interesting. Ingrid, thanks a lot for sharing with us. Well, that sounds like a story, BJ.
Sounds great, and you had me hooked at research. I'm a big fan when you can do that kind of thing. What a great story. Thanks, Ingrid.
Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Well, let's stay in Wisconsin. You've got a couple on your list. An essay collection, first of all, Here on Lake Halley by Patty C.
Yes, it's a great book. And full disclosure, Patty is a friend, a colleague of mine. We actually both share some newspaper space as part of the Sawdust Story series here at the Eau Claire Leader Telegram newspaper. And so a lot of the essays in this collection were actually born from the columns that she's written for the newspaper. It's a great book from the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It came out late last summer. And really, it's just this poignant portrait of a small town, a village, actually, right up the road from us here in Eau Claire, Lake Halley. As it's kind of a celebration of the people there. The subtitle is Barflies, Fix-It Guys, and Other Folks in Our Hometown, which I just love. It essays range from supper clubs to ice fishing to cribbage. It kind of reminds me of like Spoon River Anthology, Winesburg, Ohio, Population 45, all wrapped into one. It's a lot of fun for people who want to know more about the land where we live.
Here on Lake Halley. By the way, just got to note, John Armbruster, author of Tailspin, was on the Larry Miller Show. So you can check out the WPR.org archives if you want to hear more about that book. Another Wisconsin recommendation, you have a novel this time, Still True by Maggie Ginsburg, a Wisconsin author, I think, and set in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
Absolutely right. It's set in the small fictional town of Anthem, Wisconsin. It's the story of Lib Hansen, a woman who finds her 40-year-old son, whom she abandoned as an infant, suddenly re-entering her life, kind of upending her life in many ways. But it's also the story of her relationship with her longtime partner, Jack, who befriends a 10-year-old. They begin building bikes together. And what's interesting about this book is how Lib and Jack, though they've been together for some time, they're actually neighbors. They choose not to live together. And so I think there's this idea of distance makes the heart grow fonder, kind of personal space, finding love in a variety of methods and distances, I suppose.
And we also heard from Ron in Menominee, who couldn't stay online, wanted to give a shout out to Jeff Anania, who writes crime stories set in northern Wisconsin and the Hayward area. Yet, you know, BJ, we don't need to go around the world. We got a lot of good writing going on here in Wisconsin.
It is so true. I mean, I'm reminded of Victoria Houston, who has a lot of good fishing mysteries. She was recently in the area, and it's just so cool to see all the great work that's happening right here.
We heard from Jocelyn on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, my favorite was A Shock to the System by Simon Brett, fast-paced mystery, impossible to put down. And Jocelyn goes on, I didn't know BJ Hollers was here in Wisconsin. My favorite book from 2021, Jocelyn says, was written by him, called Flock Together. A fascinating true story about the exhaustive decades-long search for a thought-to-be-extinct bird called the ivory-billed woodpecker, a subject I knew absolutely nothing about. The book was just riveting. That's one of yours?
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's very generous. I was not expecting that. But, no, I love the opportunity to write that book. So far, we have not found that extinct bird, but we're still looking.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot for that comment, Jocelyn. Back to our callers now. Margo is with us in Menominee. Margo, hi.
Hey, Rob. Just want to recommend the book, The Farmer's Lawyer by Sarah Vogel, nonfiction, written about her successful lawsuit against the federal government in which she took on the USDA for discriminatory practices against farmers. And it was a class action lawsuit, and she won. And then she was elected the first agriculture commissioner of North Dakota who is female.
Margo, thanks a lot for sharing that recommendation. If you want to hear more, Sarah Vogel was on the show talking about that very book. That's another one. You could check the archives at WPR.org. That's along the lines of another good law and history one, like the Civil Rights Queen book, BJ.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's funny how these topics and themes do kind of continue to emerge.
And thanks for that, Margo. Speaking of staying on the theme of people who have been on this show, a piece of nonfiction you recommend, Alexandra Lang, Meet Me by the Fountain, An Inside History of the Mall. And I thought this one was super interesting. I got to talk to the author on the show and of course, read the book leading up to it. You know, the mall was just something we took for granted as kids. Really fascinating history, though.
Oh, that is so cool. You got to talk with her. You know, I just kind of stumbled upon this book a couple weeks ago. I love it. First of all, I love the title, Meet Me by the Fountain. How many times did I say that as an adolescent, you know? And so, as you mentioned, it's this nonfiction book that kind of digs deep into the rise and fall of the modern shopping mall. It's kind of this part cultural history, part architectural history, part personal reflection about how the mall kind of represents the privatization of a public space. I mean, the malls, of course, have their own benches, trees, security details, their own food and drink, their own kind of habitat. But what happens when you leave that habitat and move back to the wider world? So just a really fun way to look at someplace we go a lot in an entirely new way.
We are getting some great book recommendations. New stuff in 2022. BJ Hollers is with us from UW-Eau Claire, author himself, sharing a wide variety of books. Check out the full list at WPR.org/Central Time. still time for you to sneak in with a call at 800-642-1234. If you have a recommendation to share, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got a couple more on your list I want to get to. This one, this wouldn't have maybe been on my radar right away. Kind of a memoir by somebody who'd been a child star. I'm Glad My Mom Died. Is the title.
Yeah, talk about a title, right? It's by Jeanette McCurdy. It's a brand new memoir. Jeanette McCurdy is a child actor made famous for a 2000s era Nickelodeon show called iCarly. I don't know anything about this show. You don't need to know the show to enjoy the book. It's not a traditional actor's memoir. Instead, it's this highly personal account of Jeanette McCurdy's mother's micromanaging of her career and her life, how her mother controlled every calorie, every physical appearance related thing, her grooming, her daily life, and often kind of the long-term negative effects of these parenting decisions. And so this book really goes to some dark places about McCurdy's eating disorders, her addiction. But in the end, I think there's some nice empowerment about how to go through that. There's a famous line that Mary Carr, the memoirist, asks writers to do, which is, what would you write if you weren't afraid? And I feel like this book is the answer to that question.
Memoir is something I don't always seek out, honestly, BJ. Are there others you'd steer me toward that kind of fit that guideline you just mentioned?
Oh, gosh. You know, I'm with you. I mean, sometimes memoirs feel like navel gazing, like you're just going so close. Honestly, these days I'm reading so much historical stuff. I don't read a ton of memoirs myself. I think Wild, of course, is like the memoir from the last 10 years. Everyone's reading Wild by Cheryl Strayed. And indeed, that's a fun one to come back to.
And then we've got The Many Daughters of Afong Moy. This is a novel by Jamie Ford. And this looks like sort of an epic scale sort of thing, but very deeply personal, too.
Absolutely. You said it exactly right. It is epic in many ways. What's so cool about this book is that it's kind of part historical fiction, part speculative fiction. This book weaves together the past, the present, and the future, all around this singular idea of epigenetics, which is kind of the scientific theory that trauma can pass from one generation to the next. And there's scientific proof of this now, which is really interesting. And so it talks about Afong Moy. It's kind of the anchor of the book, who was the first Chinese woman ever to come to America in 1834. And then the book kind of splinters off into these five different characters of Afong Moy's future generation relatives, you know, and kind of how their lives changed and the traumas they have as a result of Afong Moy's initial traumas.
In our last couple of minutes, we've got, you know, the holiday season coming. Maybe we get a few days off depending on travel plans and things like that. Are there types of books you turn to when you think, okay, I've got a few days, work, you know, maybe I could set aside for a bit and really just dig into something?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I do find I love a good thriller these days, just to take my mind away from everything else. So there's an author named Greg Iles who has this trilogy of kind of civil rights era mysteries. They kind of, again, bridge the past with the present, and they're just really fun, again, page turners. So those are kind of my guilty pleasure reads.
And is there, again, you mentioned you read a lot of history for your own research and work, but it sounds like also for your own edification. Is there a period of history you're particularly zoomed in on lately?
Well, I'm hard at work on a book on JFK's primary in Wisconsin, actually, 1960 primary. It was a make or break primary for Kennedy. He ended up beating Humphrey, of course. Had he not, he would have thrown in the towel. And so I've been very curious about that particular moment. So I've been digging pretty deep into the Kennedy early years.
Do you have a title yet? We need to let the other shows know they can't have it.
Sure. It's coming out with Wisconsin Historical Society Press. It's called Wisconsin for Kennedy. The subtitle might be something like The Primary That Made a President. So something like that.
BJ, thanks so much for sharing all these great reads with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much, Rob.
That's BJ Hollers, Associate Professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. We talked with him about some of his favorite new books of 2022. You can find the full list of his picks on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. You can keep the book conversation going. Let us know your favorite new books, favorite authors from this year over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some more of you. James wrote, Kindra Neely's Numb to This, a powerful graphic novel. I think that one's by a survivor or body survivor of a mass shooting, if I'm not mistaken. Thanks for sharing that with us, James. Kathy wrote American Dirt. That's a novel from 2020 by Janine Cummins. Sarah wrote, I'd read that one already. Sharon wrote Blue Lake by Jeffrey Bolt. Thank you all so much for sharing those great reads. Coming up, a case before the U.S. Supreme Court raises issues of free speech and discrimination. A court watcher tells us what's at stake. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.